I'm here to help you, I said. I put my hand on his shoulder. I can feel the fire on my feet, he said. Your feet are right here in this cool bed, I said. I'm freezing, he screamed. I'll get you another blanket, I said. Hell is ice, he said. His teeth was chattering. He looked like he'd seen something in the air in front of him. Get back, he cried. There's nobody here but me, I said. Leave me alone, he shouted. I put both my hands on his shoulders and tried to push him down on the pillow. He swung at me and hit me in the face with his burned hand. The pain made him groan. I won't go, he whispered. You don't have to go nowhere, I said. I seen that the laudanum had wore off. The pain was coming back worse than before. I got the blue bottle from the nightstand and poured a spoonful of the cold liquid. You need to drink this, I said. Won't do no good, he said. It helped before, I said. You'll poison me, he screamed. I had to think of some way to make him drink the laudanum. Otherwise, the pain would kill him. Even if I had to trick him, I had to make him take it. If you don't drink this, I'll have to leave, I said. No, he cried. I'll have to leave you to holler by yourself, I said. It hurt me to say a lie, but I couldn't think of any other way to make him take the laudanum. He closed his eyes and opened his mouth, and I poured the liquid between his lips. Some of it dribbled out the corner of his mouth, but most of it went down. It was a bigger dose than the first one. I used all the rest of the laudanum. The devil has long, dirty claws, Mr. Pendergast said, and his claws are poison. He won't get his claws on you, I said. I felt like I was talking to a little child. The devil is trying to get in bed with me, Mr. Pendergast said. You lay back down and rest, I said. I pushed him gently back on the pillow. The devil is going to choke me, he said. Ain't nobody here but you and me, I said. As the laudanum took effect, I seen his eyes get wet and glassy and blacker than ever. He was still troubled in his mind, but numbed by the tincture. His eyes roved around the room like he was trying to see where the evil spirit was hiding. You get some sleep, I said. He laid on the pillow and took this deep breath. It was the kind of breath you hear somebody take when they're asleep. You expect them to take it in and then let it out. I waited without hardly knowing I was waiting. But Mr. Pendergast did not breathe out. I looked at him, and his eyes was open, but not moving. Mr. Pendergast, I said. I put my hand over his nose, but didn't feel any breath. I put my ear to his chest, but didn't hear any heartbeat. Mr. Pendergast was dead. One moment he had been alive and afraid, and the next he was dead. He went just like that. It was amazing how easy it was for a human life to end. A person could die and you wouldn't hardly know it. I put my fingers on his eyes and closed them. Just then, I heard Hank at the door. The day after Mr. Pendergast died, I felt 10 years older. The doctor Hank had found on the other side of Tigerville said he thought Mr. Pendergast had a stepson in California and a stepdaughter in Columbia, but he didn't know their addresses and didn't even know their names. I was wore out and the kitchen was a ruin. Ma Richards blamed me for all of it, and that seemed mighty unfair to me. I had knocked the grease out on the stove, but it was me that drug Mr. Pendergast out of the burning kitchen, and it was me that put out the fire with wet sacks. Hank was irritated because he didn't know what to do about the house and about reaching Mr. Pendergast's relatives. We may not have a roof over our heads, he said the morning after Mr. Pendergast died. We don't even know where to bury him, Ma Richard said. There we was, in somebody else's house down in South Carolina and him laying a corpse in the front bedroom. We might be throwed out, and I might be accused of burning the kitchen, or maybe even of killing Mr. Pendergast. Everything looked so bad, the weight crushed down on me. "Carry him into the kitchen," I said to Hank. I cleaned off the big kitchen table so it was bare. That was the only clean place in the kitchen. Everything else was black with soot. "You can't lay out a corpse," Ma Richard said. "That's a job for an older woman." "I help lay out Papa," I said. "We don't even know what his kin wants to do with him," Hank said. "He's got to be laid out in any case," I said. "You ain't even got a cooling board," Ma Richard said. "We'll have to use the table," I said. I cleared the stove and washed the burned grease off with soap. When I started a fire in the box, the stovetop smelled like burned lard and soap as it heated up, but that was soon singed away. I brought a kettle of water to a boil. There was so much to be done, and I had to work my way through it. But the more I done, the calmer I got. I scrubbed the soot and grease off the floor, and then we carried in Mr. Pendergast's body, and I stripped off his clothes. Since he was already getting stiff, he needed to be laying on something flat and hard. I washed every inch of him with soap and water and put a handkerchief soaked in camphor on his face to keep it from turning brown, the way I had seen it done with Papa and my senior. And then I rubbed oil all over his skin. Mr. Pendergast's bowels had moved after he died, and I had to clean that up, too. "You oughtn't to have to do that," Hank said. I'd never done anything Hank told me not to do. I didn't even know if I could, or if a wife should do something her husband said not to do. But if Hank just fussed, as he usually did, I felt justified in going ahead with what I was doing. "Somebody's got to make a casket," I said. "I need to go down to the crossroads and tell the preacher," Hank said. "There'll have to be a service." "There'll have to be a casket," I said. "You think you could do that, too?" Hank said. "I was thinking you could," I said, but wished I hadn't. "I'll decide what I do and when I do it," Hank said, and looked at me hard. A chill went through my bones. A sick iciness sunk in my belly. Hank and me hadn't quarreled before. It was the surprise of Mr. Pendergast's death and Ma Richards being there that made him lose his temper. "Hank," Ma Richards said. I hadn't noticed she was standing in the doorway. "Hank," she said, "you've got to show who's wearing the breeches in this house." "Don't it look like I'm wearing the breeches?" Hank said. "You're used to things being easy," Ma Richards said. Instead of answering her, Hank walked out of the room, slamming the back door. I looked at Ma, and I looked away. I was so mad I couldn't think of anything to say. I kept washing Mr. Pendergast's legs. I scrubbed his feet, between the toes and under the arches. His toenails was black, but I decided I wouldn't trim them or clean them. Soon as I finished washing his body, I wet his hair and combed it with a comb I found in his room. Dressing the body was harder than washing it. I found some drawers in the bedroom and a shirt I'd washed myself. And I found a suit of clothes hanging on a nail, but they was wrinkled. I sprinkled the wool and heated the iron on the stove and pressed the suit. It took a lot of lifting and rolling of the body to get it dressed. The arms and legs was setting stiff as wood. The eyes come open when I moved the head, and I had to brush them closed again. Hank had gone out in the backyard, and I heard him sawing and hammering. There was a stack of old boards in the barn, and I seen he was hammering together a box from chestnut boards. With a corpse dressed and laying on the kitchen table, I started thinking about fixing some breakfast. None of us had ate since the day before. I hated to fix something to eat with a corpse laying there, but there was nothing else to do. We had to eat, and we had to get on with things, and I meant to show Ma Richards I could go on in spite of whatever she said. I wiped the soot off the top of the meal bin and scooped out some cornmeal. "You're not going to cook with that thing laying there," Ma Richard said. "I won't touch the body," I said. "I'm not eating round a corpse," Ma Richard said. I didn't answer her. I wasn't used to talking back to older people, and it wouldn't do no good to snipe at her. I wiped off the coffee pot and poured some fresh water in it. "Would you grind some coffee?" I said to Ma. Without answering me, she took the can of coffee beans out to the back porch. I got some fresh ribs out of the dishpan where they had been setting overnight. They'd been partly cooked in the fire and soot made them black. I rubbed the smut off and put 8 or 9 in the frying pan. Soon the kitchen smelled like frying meat and boiling coffee and baking cornbread. Hank was still hammering when I called him in. "Where are we gonna eat?" Hank said. Mr. Pendergast laid on the kitchen table like he was in state in a public place. "There's nowhere to put the body till you get a casket made," I said. "I'm not half done," Hank said. "I'm not eating with that thing in here," Ma Richard said. I give everybody a plate and serve the cornbread and molasses and fresh ribs. We sat as far away from the table as we could, eating on our laps. I was near starved, and Hank and Ma Richards was near starved, too. We ate everything I'd fixed and drunk all the coffee. It didn't matter that Mr. Pendergast was laying there a corpse after we took the first bite. "This is like a wake," Ma Richards said, her mouth full of cornbread and molasses. "We are like sin eaters," Hank said. "I never believed in such dreadful stuff," Ma Richard said. "What is a sin eater?" I said. "Somebody the family pays to eat supper off a corpse, like they are taking on all the sins of the dead person," Hank said. "What an awful idea," I said. "It's just a story," Hank said. After Hank finished the chestnut box and we put Mr. Pendergast in it with his hands folded, we set the coffin on 2 chairs in the living room, and there he laid until the funeral on Wednesday. I kept handkerchiefs soaked in camphor on his brow, and I tried not to look at him as I went about my work. But it was hard not to glance at the face under the handkerchief, like I was expecting it to come awake and say something. One of the neighbors, George Poole, who runs the store at the crossroads, come by, and I asked him about Mr. Pendergast's children. George Poole was a big man whose belly punched out below the bib of his overalls. "Last I heard, Butch was somewhere in California," he said. "You don't know what town?" I said. "All I heard was he went to California," Mr. Poole said. "And how about his stepdaughter?" I said. "Now Caroline is down in Columbia somewheres," Mr. Poole said. He looked closer at Mr. Pendergast. "Everybody looks younger in death," he said. "I wonder why." "Because they have stopped worrying," Ma Richard said. "All the grief goes out of them if they went to heaven." "Does anybody know Caroline's address?" I said. "Is there any cousins or aunts or uncles here on Gap Creek?" "Now, Caroline and Butch was stepchildren," Mr. Poole said. "I don't think they kept in close touch." "His wife was married before?" Ma Richard said. "She must have been," Mr. Poole said. "She already had the young'uns when she come here." George Poole sat with us for several hours, looking at the chestnut box and making conversation. It was his way of being neighborly, of keeping vigil. But it all felt a little strange because we wasn't even Mr. Pendergast's kin, and George Poole and Mr. Pendergast had not been close friends either. "Pendergast kept to himself," George Poole said. "He hunted ginseng and trapped for muskrats. He done anything he could do on his own. He never liked to go off on public works. In the last year or two, he was too feeble to go out in the woods much, but he would buy ginseng from other diggers." "I never seen him go beyond the cowshed," Hank said. "He hid his money somewhere," Mr. Poole said. "Everybody thinks he hid a lavish of pension money somewhere." I didn't say nothing about Mr. Pendergast's jar of money, and Hank didn't bring it up either. It didn't seem like any of George Poole's business. "Where did he keep his money?" I said to George Poole. "People say he hid it in a fruit jar somewhere in the backyard," Mr. Poole said. "Maybe that was just a rumor," Hank said. "People is liable to say anything," Ma Richards said. "I'm just saying what other people has said," Mr. Poole said. The funeral for Mr. Pendergast was the pitifulest thing you ever seen. There must not have been more than a dozen people there. Mr. Pendergast didn't have relations on the creek, and it was a cold, rainy day. Gap Creek Church was open to the rafters, and the preacher's voice seemed to echo up into that empty space. I expected bats and rats to be scratching around up there over the congregation. Preacher Gibbs and his wife sung a song, and it was the mournfulest thing you could ever hear. They sung On Jordan's Stormy Banks, and it was slow and sad. A song like that can sometimes make you feel sweet with the sadness. Music can make time and a lifetime seem precious. But the way they sung On Jordan's Stormy Banks was like all the life and all the joy was draining out of the world. There wasn't a thing to hope for. It was the bad kind of sadness. It was the sadness of sin, not the sadness of love and piety. "When we come to the end of the way," Preacher Gibbs said, "what will we have to say for ourselves?" And the way he said it, you felt nobody would have anything good to say for themselves, that it was hopeless from the beginning, and there wasn't nothing anybody could say for themselves. I always hated that kind of preaching, especially at a funeral. For if somebody is dead, there ain't nothing you can do for 'em, and it's too late for them to change their ways. All that kind of sermon can do is make other people feel bad. They leave a funeral feeling worser than when they come. A funeral should make people feel glad they're still alive. "The wages of sin is death," Preacher Gibbs said, and his words rumbled and rattled in the loft. Every word he said was swallowed up by the stillness and darkness up there in the rafters. "This generation of vipers," Preacher Gibbs said. I had the awfulest feeling watching Mr. Pendergast laying there in his box with no kinfolks around to mourn and bury him, and the preacher talking sad and harsh to the empty church. It was like we had come to the end of things, almost before my life and marriage had got started. Ma Richards was sitting on my right, and Hank on my left. There was no place I could go except forward in time, toward death. The bottom was falling out of the world. The bench I sat on was still there, and the floorboards was solid under my feet. But everything important was falling away, and when I closed my eyes, I felt like I was falling into a pit and being hit over the head with the preacher's words. When the funeral was finally over, it took all the men there to carry the box out to the graveyard on the hill behind the church. After the preacher's words, even the cold rain felt soothing. I had a headache, and my belly hurt like I had ate a green apple. Yellow leaves still hung on the hickories, and a crow called its heckle from the pines further up the mountain. The mountains were so steep on both sides of Gap Creek, it felt like we was at the bottom of a big grave. Hank had dug the grave himself that morning, and the heaped dirt by the hole was so red it seemed to blister and sparkle in the gray light. Something about the raw dirt around a grave always shocks you, like it was a hungry mouth that human flesh is fed to. "First comes death," Preacher Gibbs said, "and after that, the judgment." The crows cawed in the pines. "As for man, his days are as grass, as a flower of the field, so he flourisheth. But the wind passes over, and it is gone, and the place thereof shall know it no more." As Hank and three other men lowered the casket into the hole with ropes, the preacher and his wife sung, "Shall We Gather at the River?" And I must say, it was the perfect song to be sung over a grave. It was a song I had always loved, and even in the rain and wet dirt, I began to feel better about the funeral and about the preacher. Preacher Gibbs was just doing what all preachers do at funerals. It was the cold, empty church that had made his words so sad and made me feel so sad. Preacher Gibbs and his wife kept singing by the grave in the rain, and they sung every verse of the song. They had fine, clear voices. As we walked back to the house after the funeral, Ma seemed more cheerful than I had ever seen her. I guess the fact that she was older than Mr. Pendergast and she was still alive had cheered her up. You would have thought his funeral had reflected glory on her. She was smiling to herself, and she walked tall and fast. She grinned like she had a special secret. I've never seen her so sweet. I was tired out and wrung out, and she walked up the Gap Creek Road like she was 15 years old. Chapter 6. When we got back to the house, I was so dragged out I dropped on the sofa. Two chairs were still facing each other in the middle of the living room where the casket had laid. The house needed a cleaning, and the kitchen needed to be fixed up, scrubbed down from ceiling to floor. Mr. Pendergast's room had to be cleaned up and his stuff sorted and washed. But the house didn't even belong to us, and I didn't know who should do all that work. "You rest," Ma Richards said. "I'll fix some supper." "I'll get up in a minute," I said. "Just need to rest my feet." "Hank, you got to look after Julie," Ma Richards said. Hank was warming his hands by the fire. We was all cold and wet. "I'm fine," I said. "You're expecting," Ma Richards said, "unless I miss my guess." "Is that a fact?" Hank said to me. But he acted embarrassed, or maybe took by surprise. "I don't know," I said. "How long has it been?" Ma Richards said. "Nearly 2 months," I said. "That settles it," Ma Richards said, like she had took charge of the house. Her face was bright and her eyes sparkled. Suddenly I seen why she had been so cheerful. Just the thought of becoming a grandma had cheered her up. "Settles what?" Hank said. "Settles the fact that I'm going to stay here and help Julie out," Ma Richards said. "Don't need help," I said. A chill passed through me. I had thought Ma would be leaving in a few days. It was the one thing that cheered me up, the thought that she would be gone and Hank and me could get back to living our lives. "You're going to need a lot of help," Ma said. I looked at Hank. He stood by the fire and didn't say nothing. Though I had never said so, I was sure he knowed how much I resented Ma Richards being there. I couldn't say nothing against his mama, but she irritated me. And she irritated him, too, but he was a man, and she treated him different. And besides, she was the only mama he had ever knowed. "I don't even know for sure I'm expecting," I said. It seemed to me that if Ma Richards stayed with us any longer, I would have to leave myself. I would walk back up the mountain and stay with Mama and my sisters. "You are," Ma Richards said, like it was somehow a credit to her. I got short of breath. I felt that if I didn't get Ma out of the house, I was going to have to run away. "We probably won't even be staying here," I said. "We don't know whose house this is now." "You don't want to move in her condition," Ma said to Hank, like I was a little girl and they had to decide for me. It was what she wanted to do, take charge of the house and of Hank. She wanted to treat me like a little child, her child, and she wanted to be in charge of the baby even before it was born. "I don't know what we'll do," Hank said. "We may have to leave here any day," I said. "You can stay till one of Mr. Pendergast's heirs shows up," Ma said. "I don't see what's to stop you." "The county will sell this place for taxes if somebody don't show up," Hank said. "Then you pay the taxes and you can buy it," Ma said. "Don't have enough money," Hank said, and spit his tobacco juice in the fire. His jaw always tightened when he talked about money. He didn't like to talk about money. "We don't know where we'll be living," I said. "And we don't know if I'm expecting for sure." "Well, if I'm not wanted here, I sure don't mean to impose myself," Ma said. I didn't answer her, for I didn't want to ask her to stay. "We want you to stay as long as you can," Hank said. He looked at me. "But we may be moving back to Painter Mountain with you."
"With me?"
"Where else would we go?" Hank said.
"I'd have to fix up the loft for you," Ma said. "There'd be no other place for you to sleep."
"Exactly," Hank said. "I'll take you back to Painter Mountain, and you can fix up the attic for us."
"You'll need a lot of help here," Ma said. "Julie can't clean up this place by herself."
"They may throw us out any day," Hank said. "And besides, I'll help her do what has to be done."
Hank knowed how to talk to Ma Richards. He had growed up with her ways and knowed what to say.
"When do you want to go?" Ma Richards said. All the cheer had gone out of her.
"I was thinking Sunday, because I don't have to work," Hank said.
"I hate to travel on the Lord's day," Ma said.
"The Lord will understand," Hank said. But Ma Richards had to get in the last word.
"Somebody will have to take care of this house," she said.
"I think I can manage," I said. I felt like I was falling in love with Hank all over again, because he had understood how much I wanted Ma Richards to leave, and because he had helped me. I wanted to run to him and kiss him on the neck and on the cheek. He was dearer than he had ever been. He had saved me from his mama. While everything else was going wrong or up in the air, at least I was going to have the house to myself again. That seemed to mean everything. If I could just be alone in the house to do my work and to clear my mind, I might be happy again. The next Sunday morning, Hank hitched up the horse and buggy and helped Ma Richards into the seat. I stood in the yard and waved to her as they drove away.
"Don't strain yourself now," Ma called.
"I think I can manage," I said.
"Whenever you feel tired, just go and sit down," Ma said.
"I am 17 years old," I said.
"That's why I worry about you," Ma said.
"Don't worry about me," I said.
"And remember, almost all women get sick in the morning," Ma said.
I stood on the steps and watched the buggy get smaller and smaller up the creek road. The farther away it got, the better I felt. When the horse's head and then Ma's and Hank's heads disappeared around the bend, I felt a peacefulness settle through me, like all kinds of dust and soot had settled to the ground, leaving the air fresh and bright. The week after Mr. Pendergast's death, it turned cold again. Hank went back to work at the cotton mill at Lyman, and I was sick nearly every day. Each morning I throwed up in the chamber or off the back porch, and then sat in the kitchen sipping some hot tea. After having Ma Richards there all those days, and after worrying about Mr. Pendergast ever since we moved in, I enjoyed the peacefulness each day, soon as my belly settled down. You wouldn't believe how good I felt those days after my stomach calmed. I washed the dishes and dried them and put them on the shelf. Then I took a bucket and rag and washed the floor. It made me feel strong to get down on my knees on those rough boards. It was like a morning prayer, kneeling on the cold boards and crawling backwards to rub away any dirt with the rag. That's when I felt how much it meant to have a home, a place to live in day after day and night after night. As I scrubbed the floor, I was scrubbing part of the world, and I was scrubbing my mind to make it clear. It was work that made me think clear, and it was work that made me humble. I could never talk fast, and I could never say what I meant to people or tell them what they meant to me. My tongue was never loosened by my feelings. It was with my hands and with my back and shoulders that I could say how I felt. I had to talk with my arms and my strong hands. When I finished scouring the floor, I took the bucket of dirty water out to the back porch and emptied it. I was rinsing out the bucket with fresh water when I seen a buggy pull off the road. I didn't think nothing about it at first, for peddlers and buyers of ginseng and herbs come around from time to time. This buggy looked new, and its black top and sides sparkled. The horse that pulled it was black, and its sides sparkled like they had been shined with shoe polish. My breath tightened in my throat the way it always did when I seen a stranger. I rinsed out the bucket and throwed the water in a flashing streak across the yard. A hen got hit and run away cackling. Another hen rushed to peck where the water had splashed. The buggy stopped in the yard, and I put the bucket down and hurried out to meet it. "How do?" the driver in a black suit said and tipped his hat. "Howdy do," I said. He stuck the whip in its socket and tied the reins to a ring on the side of the buggy. "My name is Gerald James," he said. "I'm an attorney from Greenville." "Pleased to meet you," I said. "My name is Julie Richards." But a chill rung through me. I knowed a lawyer couldn't be bringing good news. "Is this the property owned by Vincent Pendergast?" he said. "It is," I said. "But Mr. Pendergast died last week and was buried on Wednesday."
"Precisely," the lawyer said. "Precisely."
"I took care of Mr. Pendergast and of the house," I said. There was a cold wind coming down the valley, and I was starting to get chilled without my shawl.
"I saw the notice of Mr. Pendergast's death in the Greenville paper," the lawyer said. He took a sheet of paper out of his case.
"Do you represent Mr. Pendergast's heirs?" I said.
"Not exactly," Mr. James said. "Since Mr. Pendergast has no will, or at least not one anybody has found, it's not clear who his heirs are. His stepchildren, wherever they are, may or may not have a legal claim to the property."
"I see," I said.
"For all I know, your claim may be as good as theirs," Mr. James said.
"My claim," I said.
"By right of occupancy," he said. "That would be for a court to decide."
"We would have to go to court," I said.
"Precisely," Mr. James said.
It was his favorite word, and he made it sound like a sharp knife cutting through fat. "My husband and me don't want trouble," I said. I wished Hank was there to talk with him.
"But I'm here on another matter," Mr. James said. "I represent the Bank of Greenville, which holds a lien against the property."
He took two more sheets from his case and held them out for me to see. I didn't really look at them. I figured he would tell me what they said.
"Do we have to move out?" I said.
"Not necessarily," the lawyer said. "That's what I'm here to talk about."
I invited Mr. Gerald James inside. I was shivering in the wind. When we got into the living room, I asked him to sit down on the sofa, and I throwed another log on the fire. "Would you like some coffee?" I said.
"That would be splendid," he said. "I did get a little chill driving up the valley."
There was still some warm coffee in the pot, and I poured him a cup and brought it to the living room. Mr. James pulled his chair closer to the fireplace and took a sip of coffee.
"I understand there was a fire," he said.
"I was rendering lard and some grease caught fire," I said.
"Was there much damage?" he said.
"The curtains burned and some boards on the floor got charred," I said. "I put it out with wet sacks."
"And Mr. Pendergast got burned?"
"He got burned on his head and face and on his hands," I said.
"How did Mr. Pendergast get burned so badly?" Mr. James said.
"He was trying to put out the fire and save his property," I said. "A can of kerosene flared up and caught his hair." And that was the truth. I wasn't telling Mr. James a lie.
"Did Mr. Pendergast tell you where he kept his money?" the lawyer said.
Wind made the house shudder and the windows rattle. A puff of smoke come out of the fireplace, as it always did when there was a gust from the north. The smoke reminded me all too much of the fire in the kitchen.
"He never did," I said.
And that was true. Mr. Pendergast had never let on he had money until he crawled into the fire to save the jar behind the stove. Mr. James smiled at me.
"What are you folks planning to do now?" he said.
"We will stay here and look after the place until the heirs come," I said.
"I can see that you're honest folks," he said.
"We try to be," I said.
"That's why I would hate for the bank to foreclose," he said, and took another sip of coffee.
"What do you mean?" I said.
"We want to do the Christian thing," he said, "but if the bank can't collect the interest due on the loan, it will have to seize the property."
"I wish my husband were here to talk to you," I said.
"The case is very simple," Mr. James said. "If the bank can't collect the interest due on the loan,
it will have to foreclose. But Mr. Pendergast's heirs don't even know he's dead yet, as far as I know, I said. I understand that, he said, but the bank will have to act in any case. When Hank comes back, you can talk to him, I said, feeling flustered. I'm sorry to bring you bad news, Mr. James said.
We don't have a place to move to, I said.
Well, there's no reason you would have to leave if the bank can collect its interest, the lawyer said.
You mean we could stay here? I said.
As long as the payment was made, I don't see why not, Mr. James said.
It seemed to me I owed it to the heirs not to let the bank take the house before they even knowed Mr. Pendergast was dead. It was my job to look after the place until they showed up. I just wished Hank was there to help me decide what to do.
I can see you've taken very good care of the house, Mr. James said.
I've tried my best, I said.
I'm sorry to surprise you this way, he said.
You have to do your job, I said.
Mr. James finished his coffee and put his cup down on the floor. I would like to help you if I could, he said.
Would you like another cup, I said.
No, thank you, I'll have to be going.
I knowed there was something I ought to do. I had to do something. When will the bank seize the house? I said.
They will have to act before the end of the year, Mr. James said. I'm sorry it has to be that soon.
What if you was to get the money, I said, for the interest?
If the interest was paid, the bank wouldn't act, Mr. James said. Could you pay the interest?
We don't have much money, I said.
The heirs could reimburse you later, Mr. James said, when they're found.
What if they ain't found? I said.
Then you could keep living here, as far as the bank is concerned.
I seen it was the thing to do, to pay the interest. It was the only thing to do, to not let the bank take the house before the heirs even knowed Mr. Pendergast was gone. And if the interest was paid, Hank and me could keep living there. How much is the interest? I said.
Well, that depends on the period you're paying it for, the lawyer said. A month, a quarter, or a year.
How much for a year? I said.
I'll have to check my papers, Mr. James said.
I think I might know where to get it, I said.
Well, that would save us all a lot of trouble, Mr. James said.
I got my shawl and hurried back through the kitchen. Mr. James followed me and stood on the porch as I run to the outhouse. Behind the two seats and the Sears and Roebuck catalog we kept to use as toilet paper was the jar full of Mr. Pendergast's pension money. Hank had put it there after Mr. Pendergast died. He said it was one place nobody would look for money. The jar was cold, as if it was full of ice. I carried it in both hands to the porch.
That belonged to Mr. Pendergast, Mr. James said.
It was his pension money, I said.
Let's count it. And I'll give you a receipt, Mr. James said.
I lit the lamp in the kitchen, and the lawyer poured the money out of the jar on the table. You never seen so many silver dollars and half dollars and quarters mixed in with dimes and dollar bills. There was even a $5 gold piece that sparkled in the lamplight. There was so much money, I felt scared. Me and Mr. James made separate stacks of all the different kinds of coins. Some were so old and had stayed in the jar so long they felt sticky.
Let's make sure this is not Confederate money, Mr. James said and laughed.
When it was all counted, there was $47.86. Is that enough for interest? I said.
That's almost enough for a whole year, Mr. James said.
I felt so relieved I almost cried, for I had found a way to save Mr. Pendergast's house for his heirs, and Hank and me still had a place to live.
The Bank of Greenville will remember that you helped us, Mr. James said, and we may just be able to help you in the future.
Mr. James opened his case and took out a sheet of paper. With his fountain pen, he wrote on the page several lines and handed it to me. Received from Mrs. Julie Richards, $47.86, interest for the loan on Mr. Vincent Pendergast's house on Gap Creek, Gerald James, attorney. Thank you for helping us, I said.
The Bank of Greenville knows it can help itself only by serving its customers, Mr. James said.
I walked out into the front yard with him and watched him climb into the buggy. He untied the reins from the post and said, "Giddy up."
I watched him turn the buggy around and start back down the road.
I stood there and watched till he was almost out of sight before it got so cold in the wind I had to run back into the house.
All day as I worked, I thought about Mr. James and how he had come out of the blue and collected Mr. Pendergast's interest for the bank. I was proud of what I had been able to do. Even though Hank wasn't there, I had paid the interest and saved the house from the bank. But the whole thing appeared stranger the more I thought about it. I had expected Mr. Pendergast's heirs to show up and demand the property and the money, not some lawyer from a bank in Greenville. There was something odd about the whole business, but I couldn't put my finger on what it was. What the lawyer said made sense, but I dreaded to tell Hank what had happened. The more I thought about it, the more I saw he wouldn't be pleased that the money was gone. I had ribs and cornbread and fresh collards ready when Hank got home from the mill. I poured him a glass of sweet milk and sat down myself before I told him about the lawyer and about the bank having a lien on the property.
"He said we have to leave," Hank said.
"No, he didn't say that," I said.
I listened to the wind outside. There was a steady roar on the ridge above the creek.
"What did he want?" Hank said.
"He said Mr. Pendergast owed interest to the bank," I said.
Hank stopped eating and looked at me. He had grease on his chin.
"You didn't tell him Mr. Pendergast had any money," he said.
"I paid the interest," I said. "He said the bank would take the house if the interest wasn't paid, but he was very nice about it."
"I bet he was," Hank said.
"He said we could stay if the interest was paid," I said.
"You didn't tell him about the jar of money," Hank said.
"I give him the jar of money for the interest," I said.
Hank stood up. His mouth was full of cornbread, and he didn't say anything for a long time.
"You stupid heifer," he finally said.
I felt ice around my heart when he said that. I felt a cold vice crush my heart in its jaws. "I had to," I said. "He said they would seize the house. I had to pay the interest." Before I knowed it, Hank swung back and hit me across the face. My cheek stung and my head rung, but I didn't hardly feel it. It was Hank's words that burned right into my heart.
"He snockered you," Hank said. "You didn't even know who that man was. He tricked you. He didn't even know Pendergast had any money until you told him, you dumb heifer."
And I seen it might be true. The lawyer had fished around until I went after the jar of money, and he had talked me into giving it to him. He had talked so convincing, I had give it all to him. Tears squirted into my eyes, and I run into the living room. I was ashamed of what I had done, and I was ashamed of what Hank had done. It was a shame I'd never felt before. It was a shame that cut through my stomach like a razor. I was so ashamed for Hank. Papa had never hit me, and Mama had never hit me since I was a little girl. When I was little, Mama used to switch me with a hickory when I sassed her, but that was when I was maybe 5 or 6. I sat on the sofa and put my head down on the arm. But I didn't sob like a little girl that's heart was broke. There was tears in my eyes, but I couldn't empty my grief out in sobs. I guess I was too shocked and too angry. I buried my eyes in my arm and expected Hank to come in and say he was sorry. I thought he would take me by the shoulders and stand me up and kiss me. He would comfort me, and then maybe we could go back to like it was before Ma Richards come and before Mr. Pendergast died. But Hank never come into the living room. I was ready for him to come, put his hands on my shoulders, and tell me how sorry he was. I was going to resist him at first. I was going to show how disappointed in him I was. I was going to make him work to win my forgiveness. I wouldn't be so easy to woo back. Instead of feeling his hands on my shoulders, I heard the back door slam. I raised up and listened. There was only the sound of the fire in the fireplace and wind brushing the eaves and the roof. Hank had gone out into the dark. Instead of comforting me, he had left me to my shame. I felt weak in my knees, I was so disappointed. Worse than the shame of being slapped was the shame of being left alone. I stood up and walked to the fire and held out my hands to the flames because I was cold inside. People are supposed to feel hot with shame, but I felt my bones had turned to chalk. I felt I had shrunk to joints and knobs of chalk and ice. I stood by the fire and waited for Hank to come back in. I studied what I would say to him, for I was awful sorry for what I had done with Mr. Pendergast's money. I had given away money that was not mine, money that would belong to the heirs by rights. I had done a foolish thing. The man that pretended to be Mr. James was a true shyster, and Hank had done a worser thing when he raised his hand against me. The longer I stood by the fire, the less I warmed up. The sound of the wind made me shudder, and the cold was deep inside me, in my bowels and in my bones. If I stood any longer and waited for Hank to come back in, I was going to freeze to death. I dreaded to go back into the kitchen, where Hank had slapped me, but there was nowhere else to go, in the whirl of feelings and the twisting around of everything. Most of the supper was still on the table, the cornbread and ribs, the collard greens and the glasses of sweet milk. Everything had got cold except the milk, which had got warm. The plates had half-ate stuff on them, and the lamp on the table throwed a yellow light on the clutter. I got a handful of kindling and tossed it into the stove and took the kettle out to the back porch. In the dark of the backyard, I couldn't see Hank anywhere. I wondered if he was out in the barn or maybe beyond the woodshed. Was he standing out there watching me? I poured the kettle full of water and carried it back into the kitchen. Was my marriage over before it had hardly started? While the water was heating up, I scraped the plates into the slop bucket for the chickens, and I put the cornbread and collards and ribs into the bread safe. I wiped the table off and threw the crumbs out the back door. With a wet cloth, I washed the table and put the dirty dishes and spoons and forks into the dishpan. When the kettle was hot, I poured the pan about half full of water. The hot, soapy water felt good on my hands and wrists. I buried my arms up to the elbows in the steaming pan and put my face close to the dishpan to feel the warmth on my chin and neck. I wished I could sink my whole body into a tub of hot, soapy water. I needed to soak myself and cleanse myself. I needed to melt away the stain of shame. I scrubbed each knife and fork, each glass and dish and bowl. I rinsed them in a pan of fresh water and dried them with a clean towel. I was finished and ready to throw the dirty water out the back door when Hank appeared in the door. "What did that lawyer look like?" he said. I had thought of a thousand things to say to Hank. I had thought of everything from apologizing to trying to shame him for smacking me. I thought of telling him I would get a gun and shoot him if he ever hit me again. And I thought of getting on my knees and begging forgiveness for the stupid thing I had done. But now that Hank had finally come back into the house, I couldn't think of a thing to say. I wrung out the dish rag in the pan of dirty water. "Can't you remember what he looked like?" Hank said. "He was just a man," I said. None of the things I had thought of to say would come to my tongue. "Is that all you can say?" Hank said. "He was a man wearing a suit and driving a buggy," I said. I tried to recall what Mr. James's face had looked like, but I couldn't remember a single detail. What was the color of his hair? The color of his eyes? Did he have whiskers or not? It had all slipped out of my mind. "Was he tall or short?" Hank said. "He wasn't as tall as you," I said, "and he was a little stoop-shouldered." "That don't tell us much," Hank said. "He said his name was Gerald James," I said. "He could be anybody," Hank said. "I wasn't studying him to remember him," I said. "I was worried about saving Mr. Pendergast's house." "You didn't worry enough," Hank said. This was the first bad quarrel Hank and me had.
and I didn't know how it was going to turn out. I didn't know if it was the end of us or not. Mama and Papa had had tiffs, but Papa had never struck Mama as far as I knowed. Papa had never struck anybody as far as I was aware. I didn't say anything to Hank that I didn't have to say, for I was still ashamed of what he had done and what I had done. I was ashamed that I couldn't think of what I wanted to say, so I just kept quiet while he fussed and fumed about the money. "Can't you remember nothing?" he said. I shook my head. "Could you recognize him again?" Hank said. "I might." "And you might not," he said. Hank was worried, and he was nervous. It confused him and consternated him that I didn't say much. He was used to a woman carrying on like Ma Richards. He was used to tongue lashing and insults. By keeping quiet, I was throwing him off balance. It was the first time I seen what power I had over his blustering bad temper. If I just waited, he would get worked up and keep butting his head against my quietness. I seen I didn't have to say much at all, could just let him fret and worry. He would use his rage against himself. "Would you recognize his horse?" Hank said. "I might," I said. He talked that way in the kitchen and then followed me into the living room, thinking up one question after another. But I didn't tell him much. I couldn't tell him nothing that would help. I let him fuss and fret and wear himself out. When it was time to go to bed, I didn't say nothing. I took the combs out of my hair and put them on the mantel, and then I got a lamp from the bureau to carry up the stairs. I don't know what it is about a quarrel that stirs a body so, but when I got under the covers in the cold bedroom, it felt like my flesh was going wild and glowing. The work had burned the chill away, and as I listened to Hank rage, I had got warmer and warmer. The fuss and the shame had spirited something inside me. As I got in bed by myself, I could feel the heat give off by my skin, warming up the covers and mattress under my back. I listened to the wind in the eaves and in the chimney and waited for Hank to climb the stairs and come into the room. I guess waiting stirs the flesh also. There is nothing like waiting to whip up the pulse and make the blood sing in your ears. I could feel the blood in my neck and chest and even in my arms, so warm it was purring. I laid in the dark, feeling the covers touch the tips of my breasts and my belly and my knees. "You was a fool," I said to myself. "You are nothing but an idiot." But the thought was not entirely painful, for if I knowed I was a fool and admitted it, at least I was standing on firm ground and could see clear where I was going. If I knowed I was a fool, I might learn to be better and to do better. Wind brushed against the roof, and I shivered, not because I was cold, but because I was so warm sparks flashed off my body. There was electric currents in the covers and in the air, and every bit of my body had a charge and a sting, like soda water on a tongue. "You are a pure fool," I said to myself. But Hank didn't come up to bed. I laid in the dark waiting minute after minute. After maybe an hour, I heard the front door slam like he had gone out. And after that, I must have dropped off to sleep, for I never did hear him come in. But in the wee hours, I was woke by the sound of steps on the stairs. Hank climbed up the stairs and opened the door. He was carrying another lamp, and he set the light on the little bureau. He had to stoop a little under the slope of the ceiling. He left his shoes downstairs by the fireplace like he usually did, and he padded around in his socks. First he unbuckled one gallus of his overalls, and then he unbuckled the other. To take off overalls, you have to unbutton the sides at the waist, but before he done that, he blowed out the lamp. I listened to him slide off his overalls and hang them on the bedpost. I heard something rattle in the corner and couldn't think what it was. And then I remembered the tin can where Hank sometimes spit out his tobacco. Next, I heard something creak and felt a draft of cold air. He had cracked the window just a hair, as he always did before going to bed. When Hank sat down on the bed to take off his socks, it shook the mattress and springs like they was jelly. I quivered with the bed and tilted as he laid down and pulled the covers over him. He was so much heavier than me that the bed shifted, and I felt I was laying on a hillside. I had to prop myself with one hand and elbow to keep from sliding over. Would Hank touch me? Would he get over his anger enough to forgive me? Had the quarrel stirred him up and spirited him up the way it had me? Would he roll over and put his hand on my breast the way he did when he felt loving? Would he whisper something in the dark that would send sparks through me down to my groin? He shifted his shoulders and pushed up against the pillow. His weight made the bed sway. Every inch of my skin stung with the itch to be touched and the need to be touched. Every place on my body itched. I wanted to reach out to him, but I know that wouldn't do. I had never reached out to him before. I was sure he didn't want me to do that. He wanted to be the one to reach out. If he was ready to love me, he would reach out. There was nothing for me to do but wait for him to make up his mind. I'd seen him do it so many times, just make up his mind all of a sudden that he wanted to be loving. I listened to the little clock ticking in the dark on the nightstand. It was the alarm clock we used to wake up at 5:30 or 6. Its tick was fast as my heartbeat. Its tick made my ears itch. The tick tickled and prickled my skin. Hank turned over and put his hand on my hip. But what he said was not love words. He didn't whisper that I was his honey or his sugar pudding. He didn't whisper that he was sorry and that I was his sweetheart love. At first, I didn't even hear what he said. It was so different from what I expected, what I wanted to hear. You know how words can seem strange if they're not what you're waiting for. "I got fired today," he said. He said it like he was almost too tired to say it. And he said it like he was explaining why he had got so mad about the jar of money, too. I know that instantly. He was saying in his own way he was sorry he had hit me. "How come?" I said. "'Cause all the bricks is made," he said. "They've got bricks enough to build the cotton mill, and they don't need me for anything else." I reached out and put a hand on his leg. I put my hand on his hip and raised my leg and put it on his. I could feel his sadness in his words and in the loose way his body laid. He was heavy with sadness. He was slow and hot with sadness. I run my hand down his hip and his leg. I smoothed the hairs around his crotch and felt him get bigger. My excitement and his sadness made me bolder than I had ever been before. I stroked him until he was long and hard as iron. I heard his breath getting deeper. "You will get another job," I said. But it seemed to me that didn't matter. In the dark, what mattered was we was together and naked. Wind shoved the side of the house way down on Gap Creek in South Carolina. We would always find a way to live, a way to get back, as long as we could love. I was going to have a baby, and that was what mattered. I run my hand through the hair on Hank's chest and pinched one of his nipples. I had not done that before. It was like everything I did was the right thing. When Hank pressed against me, I felt the sparkle in my skin where he touched. The glow had centered in my belly where the baby was. It was a coal of fire. Mama had told me you shouldn't love in the latter months of pregnancy, but it was too early to need to worry. I was free to do whatever I wanted, and what I wanted was to love Hank in our own bed in our own way. Our quarrel and the uncertainty of things made it even more important to love. As Hank rolled on top of me, it was like time slowed down and every second stretched out and strained to its limit. The dark got bigger, and everything in the dark got bigger. Hank's shoulders and elbows and hands got bigger. The seconds groaned with bigness. Every inch of flesh was large and hurt, it felt so tender. Hank worked like he was climbing a hill against me. He crawled like he was climbing up a tree. He crawled faster, and then he slowed down. He slowed down again, and then he climbed farther. He pushed like he was galloping. He climbed like he was going to the top of the tallest mountain, and he was bringing everything he had to me. Now, the strangest thing was I seen all kinds of things to eat in my mind.
I must have still been hungry after not finishing supper. I seen bright strawberries and carrots and tomatoes. I seen red delicious apples and shelled peas and boiled taters. I seen new potatoes in butter and sweet milk. I seen ripe pears so big you couldn't hardly take a bite out of them. I seen grapes so ripe and tight they would bust on your tongue. "It's going to be," Hank said. But I didn't know if he was talking about the baby or our love, or the wealth of love, which was more important than money. Hank hollered out and climbed faster. And then it was like he busted out inside me. It felt time turned inside out on the hot tongue that flicked inside me. And I felt my bones melting and my legs melting in the color that roared through me. But it was not a red flame or an orange flame. It was a blue flame that started at the back of my head and burned down my spine to my belly and out to the tips of my toes as the blue turned to purple. When Hank rolled off me, I was covered with sweat and I was plumb wore out. Chapter 7. The day after I give away the jar of Mr. Pendergast's money, and the day after Hank lost his job at the cotton mill, it was like we had to start out all over again. The only reason we had come to Gap Creek, as far as I could tell, was the job building the mill at Lyman. Gap Creek wasn't the kind of place you'd think of moving to unless you had a purpose or kinfolks there. And the fact that I had give away money that was not mine made me see how hard the world was and how much I had to learn. And the fact that Hank had slapped me made me see how troubled our marriage and our lives was going to be. I was stiff the next morning from the strain of our quarrel and from worry. But I felt cleaned out by the force of our loving, like I had been stretched, both in my body and in my mind, and that left me stiff and a little sore, the way you feel from working too hard and using new muscles. Hank rose early, but didn't make a fire in the kitchen stove. By the time I got up, the kitchen was still cold, and I had to start a fire and put on a pot to make coffee. The grass in the backyard was thick with frost. Hank brought in a bucket of milk, steaming in the cold air. "Set that on the porch," I said. "I'll strain it later." I guess he was embarrassed about our quarrel, for he didn't even answer. He strained the milk through a piece of flour sack and carried the pitcher out to the spring house. I'd never seen him so quiet. I cooked grits and fried some eggs and pieces of shoulder meat. When we sat down to eat, I said, "Can't you get a job at another cotton mill?" "Ain't another mill in walking distance," he said, "except Tigerville." "Then get a job in Tigerville," I said. "I've already tried," Hank said. "We could move," I said. "Move where?" Hank said. "Move closer to another cotton mill," I said. "That's for me to worry about, not you," he snapped. He put his coffee cup down and looked angry at me. I froze inside. I was just trying to be helpful and cheerful. I didn't say nothing else. I looked at my plate and ate my grits. I remember what Ma Richards had said about Hank being spoiled and about him quitting when things got hard. I saw that he got mean when he thought he wasn't in charge. He would get scared and mean if he thought he wasn't the boss. When he was angry, it was better for me not to say nothing, even if I was mad too. The wind had died down during the night, and I listened to the fire pop and mutter in the stove as I put some jelly on a biscuit. "They're building a store in Pumpkin Town," Hank said, "but that's nearly 10 miles away." I didn't say a thing. I would just let him do the talking if that made him feel better. I'd let him talk all he wanted to. It was having the last word that was so important to him. Since he was raised by Ma Richards, it made sense he would feel that way. He paused like he expected me to say something. I didn't. "There are houses going up here and there," he said. "I could ask for work on one of those jobs." I listened to the wood settle in the stove, and a crow called somewhere on the ridge above the creek. A hen cackled in the chicken house. "We could go back to North Carolina," I said. "Where would we live?" Hank said. "There's no room on Painter Mountain, even if we wanted to live there. I don't think we can live with your mama and all your sisters." "We could find another house up there," I said.
And what would we use to pay the rent? Hank said.
Gap Creek is fine with me, I said.
Because he was worried, Hank wanted to pick another fuss. It was something he was used to. When you're unhappy, you find a way to get angry and make somebody else angry. But I wasn't going to fall into that habit.
We might just stay here for a while, he said.
I got up and started gathering the dishes into the dishpan. I scraped the plates into the slop bucket and put the leftover biscuits and meat in the bread safe. I'm not worried about staying here, I said.
Nobody has asked us to leave, Hank said.
I thought Hank would probably go off looking for another job that day, but he didn't. Instead, he took Mr. Pendergast's shotgun and a box of shells from Mr. Pendergast's bedroom and put on his Mackinaw coat and cap.
I'm going to get us a wild turkey, he said.
But he didn't look happy about going hunting. His jaw was set in a grim way, and he looked like he just wanted an excuse to get out of the house.
I ain't seen any wild turkeys, I said.
The wild turkeys is up the holler, Hank said, up the branch, way back toward Caesar's Head. After he was gone, I cleaned up the kitchen, and then I decided to have a look around the place. With no money coming in from wages, I had to know what we had to last the winter. I would be eating for both me and the baby, and I had to see what there was to get us through till the spring, assuming we was allowed to stay in the house till spring. I didn't have but 36 cents in my purse, and I didn't know how much Hank had in his pockets. But whatever it was, we would soon run out of cash. I was not going to ask Mama to help us unless there was no other way, and I was not going to ask Ma Richards for anything. But if there was enough stuff on Mr. Pendergast's place, we might make it through the winter anyway, until the baby was born. I lit a lamp and took it down to the cellar. I doubted that Mr. Pendergast had done much canning on his own, but his wife must have at one time. I had seen those jars down there before. I held the lamp high over the jars and looked around the musty basement. There was old boards piled above the bank, and a dough board with mold on it. Mold growed white as baking soda on the beams, and then I seen the bin of taters. I had forgot the bin of taters. There was two bins, actually, Irish taters and sweet taters. The spuds must have been dug in mud, for they had dirt crusted on them. They was little taters, but there might have been 2 or 3 bushels of them. Only problem was some had already begun to get soft and wrinkled. The skin of the taters was puckered in places, like they had been dug a long time ago. I squeezed several, and some was soft, but most wasn't rotten. I'd have to pick through the pile and get rid of the rotten ones. The sweet taters looked cleaner, like they had been dug in dry dirt that crumbled off them. Sweet taters looked more like roots than Irish taters. They looked swelled up, like big blood vessels. Some was perfect as a football, but most was crooked and wrenched around. I picked through the sweet taters and found them hard and cold, like they had been dug that fall just before we moved to Gap Creek. There was a few old buckets and rusty hoes in the cellar, but I couldn't find nothing else that could be it. The basement looked like it had been long forgot, a place that was about to be buried under cobwebs and low sills and joists. I climbed back up the plank steps to daylight and blew the lamp out. The fresh air tasted so good I breathed deep to get the cellar taste out of my mouth and nose. Next, I inspected the corn crib. It was a regular old-time crib made of 2-inch slats with wire mesh nailed to the inside. It was the kind of crib with slanted sides, bigger at the top than at the bottom. There was moss and lichens growing on the slats, showing how old it was. The door was a crawl-through door, more than waist high. I pulled out the peg that held the door and looked inside. A basket on the floor held some ears of shucked corn, and a bucket of shelled corn set beside it. It was the corn I used to feed the chickens. But most of the crib was filled up with a great heap of unshucked ears. I guess there was a wagon load of corn there, the shucks gray and weathered. Grain scattered on the floor had the hearts et out by weevils, like beads that had been drilled through. I climbed in and took an ear and pulled the shuck back. Some of the grains had been hollowed out, and some not. The corn must have been 2 or 3 years old, and some of it was not fit to use.
but there was enough good corn to make some meal, 5 or 6 bushels anyway. There were strings of dried peppers hung on the back porch, but I wondered if there was anything else on the place to eat. Wasn't anything in the woodshed but wood. I knowed what was in the spring house. That left the old smokehouse where we had put the ham and shoulders and middles on the day of the hog killing. There were some jugs on the bottom shelves of the smokehouse I wanted to look at. I opened the door of the little building and let the sunlight fall on the floor where the ashes from hickory fires was heaped. The salted meat laid on the shelves, and the place smelled like salt and uncooked lard. The smell of salt made you think of cooked meat. The jugs on the lower shelves was heavy earthenware. I lifted one up and took it out into the sunlight. It was the kind of jug you think of as holding moonshine. I pulled the wooden stopper out and sniffed. It was the smell of sorghum, rich, maybe overcooked sorghum. I tilted the jug and a tongue of molasses licked out slow through the mouth. I dipped a finger in the dark syrup and brought it to my mouth. It was sorghum, all right, with a golden redness inside. No blackstrap syrup or cane syrup, but sorghum with its special smell. It was a little overcooked and thick, almost rubbery in the cold air. But the molasses could be warmed up, and they had the right flavor. There was 4 jugs of them. That would last through the winter, with syrup for biscuits and cornbread, as well as sweetening for cakes and gingerbread. There was molasses to be put on cornmeal mush in the morning, and on oatmeal. The only place I hadn't been to was the barn loft. I knowed what was in the feed room on the ground floor, the barrels of crushing and dairy feed and cottonseed meal, the bag of shorts for the hog, the laying mash and oyster shells for the chickens, sweet feed for the horse. The steps to the loft was outside the feed room, and as I climbed the steps, I seen 2 dusty china eggs on the shelf by the harness. Old horse collars and plow lines, hames and trace chains, single trees and double trees hung on nails. Mice scurried around the sacks and coils of rope as I climbed. The barn loft was a great room open to the rafters. The roof was held up by poles, and there was heaps of sweet, moldy hay in the center, near the hatch where forkfuls could be thrown down to the ground. Mice trickled along the eaves as daylight sparkled through cracks. There was a pile of shucks in the corner, and grains of corn were scattered on the floor where ears must have been piled at one time. I looked to the side of the hay pile and seen something with a wick, like the tip of a giant candle. Stepping closer, I seen it was the stem of a winter squash. There was maybe 10 squashes there, acorn squash and winter squash. They was hard and cold. And then I seen the pumpkins. They wasn't big pumpkins like you make jack-o'-lanterns from. They was sugar pie pumpkins, not much bigger than the squash. I counted 7 of them. Standing beside the hay pile, I smelled something sweeter than the hay. It was just a whiff. A trace. I looked around but couldn't name the scent, except I was sure it wasn't just the smell of old seasoned hay. I searched in the gloom and found the perfume come out of the straw. It was the scent of apples. I poked around in the edge of the hay pile until I touched something hard. There was round, hard things under the straw. I pulled the hay aside and seen the apples. They were spotted gold and orange apples. They was what Mama called horse apples, except a little bigger than horse apples. They had been gathered from the tree at the side of the barn,